The primary objective of this book was to elucidate the imperial superstructure in order to contribute to the reorientation of left politics away from the anti-communist, capitalist, and even imperialist accommodationist positions that have perverted it, and which themselves are in large part effects of imperialism. It thereby seeks to rejuvenate anti-imperialist Marxism as the necessary horizon for our struggles. It is this positive project that frames and makes coherent all of the critical elements operative in the work itself. This book also seeks, secondarily, to contribute to a rejuvenation of veritable Marxist analyses of culture that are not hemmed in by the confines of so-called cultural Marxism. In my brief presentation, I'll clarify what this book contributes to our understanding of the imperial superstructure and then provide a few concrete examples. So the superstructure is the system of institutions and practices that emerges from, but also serves to perpetuate, a society's economic base and thus its class relations. It is sometimes used as a synonym for ideology, but it has the advantage of insisting on the institutionalized material forces that produce, shape, and perpetuate ideology by composing subjects in every aspect of their lived existence, meaning not just their ideas and their worldviews, but also their perceptions, affects, desires, practices, and so forth. According to Marx's insightful analysis, the superstructure is composed of two interlocking components: the political-legal apparatus concentrated in the state and the cultural apparatus that formats social consciousness. Regarding the former, this first volume in the trilogy serves as a study of the real functioning of the bourgeois state that has increasingly come to rely on covert operations and what is called invisible government in the age of imperialism, as understood by Lenin. As class inequality became increasingly polarized and nations entered into inter-imperialist rivalries under monopoly capitalism, bourgeois states relied more and more on the men and women of the shadows. It was precisely in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that imperial powers created a host of new secret services. The desire to control vast territories while lacking the conventional military forces to subdue them, coupled with the need to understand and counter the objectives of rival imperialist nations, led to a massive increase in secret intelligence, which used espionage to find out the intentions of rival imperialists and take covert measures to suppress potential insurgencies or strengthen client regimes in the colonies themselves. When socialist state-building projects began breaking the chains of imperialism in earnest in 1917 and leveraging countries out of the global imperial order, intelligence services became that much more important for running both psychological warfare operations to manufacture animosity toward the anti-imperialists and destabilization campaigns aimed at overthrowing them. Covert operations have been particularly important for the specific model of empire building developed in the United States, which emerged from the Second World War as the leading imperialist power. A number of factors contributed to its outsized reliance on dual governance, meaning the combined use of overt and covert, visible and invisible forms of government. To begin with, the country has a long-standing tradition of imperial denial based on a powerful ideological narrative that maintains that it broke free of the British Empire, established democracy, and so forth. Secondly, it became the leader of the imperialist camp by defeating its major rivals, the latecomers to the imperial feast, Germany, Italy, and Japan. In order to catch up with and surpass their well-established competitors, these countries had engaged in an intense form of imperialist onslaught that became internationally known and condemned as fascism. To win the war against them, the United States had to tactically ally with its erstwhile and future enemy, the leader of the socialist anti-fascist camp, the Soviet Union. The foundational ideological narrative developed in the United States when it emerged on the winning side of the war was therefore that it was resolutely anti-fascist and pro-democratic. Thirdly, the anti-fascist struggle continued after the Second World War in the form of the battle for anti-colonial liberation from the Allied imperial powers. The United States, in its desire to leverage colonially dependent countries out of the grip of former imperialist powers, supported many of these struggles while ultimately seeking to shrewdly integrate these same countries into its sphere of influence and its networks of global accumulation. Fourthly, Uncle Sam took over the leadership of the imperialist camp when it was on its heels And socialism was advancing around the world as an anti-imperialist struggle of national liberation from China, Korea, and Vietnam to Congo, Mozambique, Cuba, Nicaragua, and beyond. This communist menace had to be beaten back. But this war on anti-imperialist liberation needed to appear to be an effort to internationally promote democracy and human rights. Now, with this brief and general outline, we see the two contradictory imperatives faced by the US Imperium, which go a long way to explaining why it has arguably relied more on covert operations than any previous empire. On the one hand, it had to build its empire. When imperialism was losing ground, by waging an aggressive global war on communism, which included discreetly taking over the territories formerly controlled by the Western European imperial powers. On the other hand, it needed to maintain its ideological tradition of imperial denial and appear to be in the business of promoting democracy, anti-fascism, and decolonization. In facing this impossible situation, the US state has relied extensively on its intelligence services to develop a veritable empire of spectacles, meaning an empire that aggressively advances its agenda while simultaneously creating spectacular forms of ideological obfuscation. If Hollywood can be used as a metonym for the factory of spectacles, then we might say that the United States has attempted to conquer the world under the cover of Hollywood. Rather than solely or primarily relying on military deployments to directly subjugate countries, it has used propaganda, psychological warfare, covert operations, targeted assassinations, hybrid warfare, proxy wars, neocolonialism, non-governmental organizations, electoral meddling, and many other shrewd mechanisms to achieve its ends while minimizing blowback for its actions. Now, the second component of the superstructure is the cultural apparatus, meaning the material system of cultural production, circulation, and consumption, as well as that of cultural control that formats social consciousness and is within the cultural apparatus that academic life takes place, but also that intellectual work is done. Culture then is here understood in its most expansive sense, including all of the activities that fashion human existence. In the age of imperialism, bourgeois societies exercise monopoly control over the production and dissemination of public culture, and they thereby have a degree of ideological power that is arguably unprecedented. A very small coterie of bourgeois exercise dominion over the overwhelming majority of culture that most people experience. This was one of the fundamental arguments advanced in this first volume of the trilogy, The Intellectual World War. Far from being a free realm of expression and exploration, culture, including, of course, intellectual culture under capitalism, is a highly regimented sphere of production and consumption that is under the dominion of the ownership class. Now, just as I was arguing a moment ago that the imperialist bourgeois state is characterized by dual governance, meaning that there is a use of both visible and invisible overt and covert mechanisms of government or governance, there is also within the bourgeois cultural apparatus, particularly in the age of imperialism, a tendency to tender a democratic stage, talk about the free and open marketplace of ideas, while discreetly controlling in a totalitarian manner this stage from behind the scenes. So the dual governance of the imperialist state is seconded by a slightly different form of dual governance at work within the imperial cultural apparatus. Moreover, these go hand in hand. The cultural apparatus plays a central role in the imperial activities of the bourgeois state. It functions hand in glove with the political legal apparatus to advance a common agenda. Given the unique nature of US empire building, the cultural apparatus runs cover for its imperial exploits while diligently constructing worldviews that serve the interests of the ruling class. The first volume of the study opens with an examination of the Marxist method for studying culture, but that breaks significantly with what's called cultural Marxism and its abandonment of political economy and analysis of imperialism, praxis, and much more. The opening chapter elucidates the dialectical and historical materialist approach to ideas, shedding light on the modus operandi of the intellectual apparatus of the imperial superstructure, the intellectual apparatus just being a specific component within this broader cultural apparatus that I was talking about a moment ago. The second chapter provides an overview of some of the material networks of the empire of ideas that have been constructed by the leading imperialist powers over the last century or so, and which serve as the general backdrop for the intellectual world war on the socialist alternative. The third chapter turned more specifically to the imperial theory industry as a major force for shoring up and promoting a form of compatible critical theory, meaning a form of critical theory that's compatible with the interests of capitalism and imperialism. And the reason for shoring up this compatible critical theory is because it is an ideological weapon of war against the revolutionary tradition of dialectical and historical materialism. All three of these opening chapters, meaning the first half of the book, provide the methodological and conceptual framework necessary for understanding and correctly situating all of the more specific analyses that follow, including those in this volume and the next. Now, this methodological intervention can be understood, as I mentioned a moment ago, as a rejoinder to cultural Marxism. This version, or rather perversion, of Marxism, which is prevalent in the imperial core, rejects the broad scientific project of dialectical and historical materialism, abandoning the analysis of the natural world, the dedication to praxis, as well as any serious engagement with political economy, in favor of focusing primarily on culture and, much more specifically, bourgeois culture. Cultural Marxism is, of course, critical of capitalist society and its perverse effects on culture, and it has also undertaken a critique of the culture industry. However, it tends to focus on the experience of the consumer, particularly from the middle layer, and it does not develop a political economy of culture, situate it within the cultural apparatus of imperialist states, or examine the class struggle to develop a socialist culture. As a matter of fact, certain forms of cultural Marxism, like that of figures such as Adorno and Horkheimer, celebrate select forms of bourgeois culture as being the bearers of a liberatory promise. They never clearly spell out, however, how a poem by Baudelaire, a piece of atonal music, or a Beckett play is concretely connected to meaningful social transformation, and their writings on these issues openly traffic in various forms of magical thinking. The remainder of my time is just to highlight two things. One is some of the elements that are inherent in the second half of the book, which turns to the Frankfurt School for Critical Theory as one of the foundational contributors to the tradition known as Western Marxism, and then very briefly share with you a few documents so you can have a sense of the nature of the research that I've been doing. So if you read this book, and particularly the second half of this book, you will learn that Adorno and Horkheimer openly identified communism with fascism. They directly participated in the anti-communist cultural Cold War undertaken by the imperialist powers, working with the Congress for Cultural Freedom, including after it was revealed as a front organization for the CIA. Adorno and Horkheimer also defended the 1956 imperialist invasion of Egypt by Israel, Britain, and France. They referred to Nasser, one of the prominent anti-colonial leaders, of course, of the Non-Aligned Movement, as, quote, a fascist chieftain who conspires with Moscow, end quote. This follows directly the forms of propaganda that were being put out directly by the Information Research Department in Great Britain. Horkheimer actually even openly expressed his support for the imperial project in Vietnam, claiming that in America, when it is necessary to conduct a war, it is not so much a question of the defense of the homeland, but it is essentially a matter of the defense of the Constitution, the defense of the rights of man. You'll also learn how Adorno and Horkheimer perceived Walter Benjamin as being subjected to the quote-unquote savage influence of Bertolt Brecht, by which they meant the influence of anti-imperialist Marxism, and they pressured him to move away from him while censoring openly his publications. They had ample funds to support Walter Benjamin's trip to the United States when he was fleeing the Nazis, but they did not share those funds with him, instead leaving him there to die. They then lied about this after the fact and sought to purge his corpus of its more explicit Marxist elements. These so-called Marxists were openly supported by the capitalist ruling class, particularly the Rockefeller Foundation, because they were doing the type of ideological work that served their interests. When the Frankfurt School was relocated to occupied West Germany, it worked closely with German professors who had been Nazi collaborators, and in fact, it directly integrated them into the leadership of the Institute for Social Research. The longest-serving managing director of the Frankfurt School from 1975 to 2001 was a man by the name of Ludwig von Friedeberg, who had spent more of his time as a Nazi than as a former Nazi before he began working with the Frankfurt School. And he is only one example of many others integrated into the leadership. Seven affiliates of the Frankfurt School worked for the world's leading imperialist government for a combined total of over 50 years in what I refer to as the Washington School. And this was the springboard for their careers within some of the most prestigious institutions within the imperial core. You'll also learn that Herbert Marcuse misrepresented his relationship to the Central Intelligence Agency. He not only was in regular correspondence with them regarding the work that he was doing as what at least one researcher refers to as the leading communist expert in the U.S. State Department, but he also was involved in the drafting of and debates around at least two national intelligence estimates, which are the highest form of intelligence for the U.S. government. He continued to do this work as he moved into the academy and was actually a State Department operative during the first years of his career at two Central Intelligence Agency cutouts, the Russian Institute and the Russian Center at Harvard. Moreover, he became the intellectual point person for the Marxism-Leninism Project, an enormous international project run by the Rockefeller Foundation in order to discredit Marxism-Leninism and shore up what we can refer to as Western Marxism. So I think I just have a few minutes left, and what I'd like to do is then turn finally, and this is simply to give people a taste of the type of work that I've been doing, to a few of the documents that I've been using, because I've done scores of Freedom of Information Act requests, spent a lot of time in archives and done a lot of research in digital archives as well. One of the most interesting collection of documents that I found are those by the Psychological Strategy Board. The PSB was established in 1951 in order to oversee the psychological warfare operations of the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, military services, and other government agencies. What you see in this trove of documents is really the fundamental architecture that is outlined for their psychological warfare program around the world. And one of the most important discovered in this trove of documents is what they refer to as doctrinal warfare. All of the documents on doctrinal warfare refer to it as the fight to control people's overall ideological worldview or doctrine, meaning the general framework within which specific ideas are situated, right? The reason for a focus on doctrinal warfare is that they recognized that ideology regularly comes into contradiction with empirical reality. What they wanted to do was to guarantee the gestalt, the ideological doctrine, and have it so well established that if empirical facts contradicted one's worldview, it would never actually call into question that overall framework or that doctrine. And it was very important to them to advance doctrinal warfare that was both positive and negative, meaning that the doctrine that they targeted was Soviet doctrine, the doctrine of Marxism-Leninism as manifest in real-world socialist state-building projects, and the doctrine that they put forth as the positive doctrine was that of the so-called free world, the kind of democratic West as they described it. Within that overall framework, they focused not only on intellectual production, but also on distribution and consumption. They wanted full spectrum dominance of the ideological field. And so I'll just share very briefly with you two documents. This is a 1953 PSB memo, and I've highlighted here one of the things that they claim. They say that doctrinal production is not limited to political and philosophic analyses, which they go on at length about. All fields of intellectual and cultural interests, from anthropology and artistic creations to sociology and scientific methodology, come within the gamut of the doctrinal program. Again, what they're looking for is full spectrum dominance. One of the things that they point out very regularly within these documents, I've just chosen one, but there are many others, is in the long run, the pen is much more influential than the sword. Ideological warfare is identified as more important than any form of direct military warfare, because it is the primary war, the war for hearts and minds, within which military wars and, you know, direct campaigns of this sort are inscribed. Two final elements. These two documents are actually in the appendix to the book. There's an interesting 1952 PSB memo in which they highlight regarding ideological warfare that we cannot expect to subvert the enemy if we cannot speak their language. Therefore, we have to use Marxian terms of reference. And they spell this out in some detail in the rest of the document. They say, we need attacks against communist ideology developed in Marxist terms, right? They very explicitly identified the need for a Marxist intelligentsia that was embracing the terminology, using the symbols of Marxism, but was anti-communist through and through, and attempted to demonstrate that actually existing socialism didn't abide by the true tenets of Marxism, or what they often call in some of the documents, authentic Marxism. And they also argued for a defense of Western society in Marxist terms, right? So they wanted to create an ideological environment within which people could remain attached to Marxism and nonetheless accept the fundamental ideological doctrine of imperialism. One of the thematics of the book that I think is helpful, if people haven't read it yet, to know about is that I do really insist on a dialectical critique, and I mean a number of things by that. But one is that it's always important to be attentive to the specificity of subjects and how they're situated within the objective social totality, and how those subjects have trajectories. And so they're not just fixed nodal points within some kind of overall system. So this is very far from the idea that there'd just be a system that would determine how every individual acts. It's much more a fine-grained analysis of the specificity of subjective positions within a broader objective world. And so within that, the reference that you made to Bill Donovan hiring, I can't remember if you said it was Baran or Sweezy. I don't think I actually stated either of those, but it's most likely due to the fact that I shared an earlier version of the manuscript with you, and you might be referencing that. I do think, you know, Bill Donovan did have a hand in integrating some of the early Frankfurt scholars, Marcuse Neumann and Kirchheimer in particular, but that was more of a kind of a smaller point. But I wanted to address the larger issue of the Office of Strategic Services. There's a large body of literature around it, so much so that if you reference the Frankfurt School and the U.S. National Security State, a lot of people say, well, they were fighting fascism in the OSS. Everything that they were doing, therefore, can be exonerated. And John, I know it's not what you were saying, but this is a kind of very standard line that I've seen. And it is important, as I mentioned, to engage in a dialectical critique by which we situate individual subjects on their trajectories within this objective system. The history of the Office of Strategic Services was such that they did integrate intellectuals who occupied every position on the political spectrum. They wanted right-wing, they wanted centrists, they wanted liberals, they wanted left-wing, and they did want communists, and very explicitly, because they needed people who understood communism, both because they were allying with the Soviet Union, but also because, of course, the National Security State was involved in an ongoing war on the Soviet Union. So there were multiple reasons, but they needed that form of knowledge. Now, the leadership of the OSS was very tightly controlled, though, by members of the National Security State who were deeply in bed with a financial elite, and in particular, those coming out of New York. And so that created a kind of military-industrial academic complex, right, where you have the military is the state, the industrial indexing the capitalist ruling class, and in particular, the kind of financial elite coming out of New York, and then the academy. Within that, then, there were intellectuals who were anti-fascist and who were pro-socialist and who were Marxists of a more resolute sort, not just inverted Marxism that we were talking about. Franz Neumann comes to mind because Neumann, in fact, was Donovan's right-hand man in the prosecution of the Nazis during the Nuremberg trials, and was recognized as a leading specialist on Nazism. He also, and I try to go through as clearly and carefully as I can the historical record, it is presumed that Neumann did have some connections to Soviet intelligence and most likely did share some information. The extant record isn't as transparent as we would like it to be, but there were clearly a number of very well-identified spies who were working within the OSS who did have connections with Neumann. Some information appears to have gotten out to the Soviets, including, very importantly, the ways in which Alan Dulles, who would later become the longest-serving head of the Central Intelligence Agency, was working in the OSS in Switzerland, and he was trying to negotiate peace deals with the Nazis, the Nazi high command just under Hitler, so that the Nazis could unleash the full force of their tyrannical war machine against the Soviets and have peace with the US Americans. This is what the Soviets worried about. And so Neumann potentially had his hand in one of the most important intelligence breakthroughs on the part of the Soviets. But the larger context is also, I think, one that needs to be understood. So The United States at that point in time was a racial apartheid state that had concentration camps according to its own definition, which were the camps that had rounded up 120,000 Japanese Americans who had committed no crime, were, you know, not subjected to any legal proceedings. And they were referred to as concentration camps, but that term was later changed, you know, post-World War II for obvious reasons. And there was also the beginning of an integration of Nazis into the U.S. national security state. And the forefront of that was done by the OSS, and in particular, Alan Dulles, people like Angleton, who were working in Operation Sunrise and other things after the war. So much so that Marcuse himself cites the arrival of Nazis in the U.S. national security state. So he is fully aware of the fact that he was, and this is post-World War II, when he was working in the State Department, in an organization that was fighting communism globally alongside Nazis. Now, of course, I think he was critical of that, but this is very, very important context, I think. The other thing that I point out, and there's a series of pages on this in the fifth chapter, that one of the main positions that people like Marcuse took was that you could be an anti-fascist and an anti-communist. And a question that I raise is that since fascism was defeated by, and as far as I know, Anne Lacroix has established the most coherent numbers, but 35 million Soviets and 20 to 35 million fascists, it should have been clear to most people that the war was fought in the East and the people who defeated fascism were the communists. And so the question that I raise is that, well, since fascism is a political ideology and a superstructural form that arises out of capitalism. If you are an anti-communist, capitalist accommodationist, are you really that serious about fighting fascism? Particularly when you're in an organization that is actually integrating fascists and you continue to work there. So it raises some larger questions, I think, about the complexities of the situation that they're in. But of course, none of this then would necessarily, like, everybody who can needs to work to survive. There are a lot of different reasons why people would work in certain organizations. And I think it would be very naive to just condemn anyone who worked for the OSS without looking at the specificity of the positions they took and how they developed and evolved over time in various ways. So this isn't, the argument isn't guilt by association or something like this. It is a materialist analysis and a dialectical critique that attempts to look in the most refined manner possible at all of the objective forces and the subjective decisions that were made within that. Ali, I really appreciated the fact that you really went to immediately the big stakes, and this helps frame the most important contribution of the book, because of course there are lots of historical details and I encourage everybody to read them, but I also recognize that not everybody is or wants to be a specialist in Western Marxism or the Frankfurt School or covert operations or other such things. But what you get to is the quintessential argument of the book, and that is that empire has developed a imperialist accommodationist at a minimum, but often a pro-imperialist culture that it has promoted around the world, and that this has had an enormous impact on Marxism and on the anti-imperialist struggle itself. And I begin the book by referencing the ways in which the Central Intelligence Agency was directly involved in trying to take control of Ernesto Che Guevara's literary estate, and was waging an intellectual world war and published a version of his Bolivian diaries and kind of pulled back some of the curtains so that people could see some of the machinations that were operative. One of the reasons I decided to open the book in that way is precisely in order to cue people into the most important elements in the struggle, and that is the struggle to build socialism has historically been developed primarily by the greatest victims of imperialism, and that is the peoples, the working class of the global South. And therefore, we have to situate all of these struggles, even though I'm focused on the kind of transatlantic relationship between the United States and Western Europe, in terms of the overall imperialist war, and in particular, the intellectual world war as a quintessential component of that. And I appreciate the fact that you highlighted as well how important these struggles were to the South. In fact, it was due to conversations that I had with you that I introduced a few paragraphs dealing with what I refer to at one point as a kind of comprador intellectual labor aristocracy in the South. The ways in which the labor pyramids in the intellectual world are so integrated into the imperial system that many of those who have access to funds, who have connections in the global north, who get invited to junkets, who get translated, who develop an international career, are integrated into this broader system because they're giving to the imperialist system what it demands of them. And so it has an enormously pernicious effect on intellectual developments in the global south, because many of the kind of quote unquote leading intellectuals have been trained at Oxford or Harvard or Columbia. They've been exposed to the leading ideas of Marxism or radical theory. And then they go back to the south with all of their northern credentials and bring with them what? Mainly imperialist indoctrination instead of an education concerning how to fight and win against imperialism. And so I also wanted to bring to the fore the ways in which social chauvinism isn't just a personal attitude, right? It's actually part of the institutional mechanisms that structure the global production of knowledge. And there is a kind of value flow operative in the global production and dissemination of knowledge. And one of the worst effects that a lot of Western Marxism, but also kind of French theory and contemporary radical theory has had, is it's confused and misdirected so much of the global intelligentsia in the broadest sense of that term, right, including political leaders, union organizers, journalists, intellectuals, etc. The other thing that you highlighted, of course, Ali, is that the real base for all of this isn't just the intellectual world war. It's that what this does is it provides cover for, legitimates, helps perpetuate a level of social murder that is just truly incredible and boggles the imagination, that goes hand in hand, of course, with the great work that John has been doing for decades on this, of just ecocide, right? And so we're living in an era of exterminism, as Georges Gastaut has called it, where it really is code red for humanity. The degrees of social murder, of ecocide, the risks of nuclear apocalypse, all of these have put us in a situation where the stakes of class struggle in theory and practice are arguably higher than they've ever been. And so the reason for engaging with in this work is that I have my critiques of Western Marxism, I have my critiques of the kind of imperial theory industry and the imperial intellectuals in general. But the overall framework within which all of that takes place is a positive project of shoring up, rejuvenating, intensifying an anti-imperialist Marxist orientation, the traditions of dialectical and historical materialism in all of their depth and breadth, because they're the most important weapons that we have in class struggle. And unfortunately, due to some of the things I've said today and that are in the book, there has been an attempt to steal this weapon from us and to wield it against us in ways that we need to understand and be not simply to engage in critique, but so that we can really take ownership over that weapon and continue to collectively develop the most important weapon of class struggle that we have. The goal is clarity and to elucidate how intellectual work cannot simply be studied as we're trained to study it within the bourgeois humanities or even the bourgeois social sciences. It has to be situated within the objective social totality, and it needs to be situated in relationship to the principal contradiction of life on planet Earth, which is imperialism. This is the most important question, the underdevelopment and destruction of the overwhelming majority of the population and the planet. That's the question. And so we need clarity on that. That said, and I'm glad that you highlighted this, I insist on it in the book regularly. I engage in a dialectical critique as well, because as you kind of alluded to, you know, if it be Marx or Engels or Lenin, like they all insisted that bourgeois culture is the most developed culture in the sense that it has the greatest material force behind it and promoting it. The intellectuals I'm talking about have had the greatest access to the material resources necessary to do intellectual work. It would be shocking if they didn't have something of value to contribute insofar as they have had the best conditions to produce that. So it's not a matter of throwing everything out or burning books or any silly ideas like this. You learn whatever you can from it, but most importantly, you situate it within the objective framework of class struggle that I was mentioning. And I love your comparison to the kind of lie of progress, because the way I was exposed and many people are exposed to these ideas is that Marxism is reductivist, it's teleological, it's deterministic, it never thought about the colonial question or the racial question or the woman question. There's all these myths about Marxism, and there's an implicit teleology that positions Western Marxism or these radical theories as more advanced, more developed, because they deal with subjective issues, with race, with cultural issues, and all of this, all of this narrative is thoroughly incorrect. It's based on a profound misrepresentation of the traditions that we're talking about. And it creates, to reference what you were saying, a kind of inverted version, right? It takes regressive intellectual and political tendencies. They're regressive intellectually. They've given up on dialectical materialism, right? They've tried to unmoor dialectics from materialism so it can just spin freeform in these subjectivist, you know, games and rhetorical maneuvers. And they try to these regressive tendencies as more advanced than the dialectical and historical materialist project that they're denigrating. So what you're highlighting is really one of the key elements ideologically is people think, well, why should we read Etkin or Che or any of these people? We should really read, I don't know, Achille Mbembe or somebody who's doing really quote unquote cutting edge work today. And this implicit teleology is really strongly pushed by the intellectual apparatus. And you can get access to all of this information. It's what's, you know, or all of these books and these publications. It's what's trendy. They do the same thing in the theory industry that they do in the broader cultural industries, right? Pushing Marvel films isn't that much unlike, although there are, you know, certain differences one would have to introduce, to pushing the hottest commodities on the intellectual market. One of the ways that I try to frame and elucidate this in the book is that the imperial superstructure provides uplift, meaning that those who give to the system what it wants tend to ascend within the system. And so it's not a matter of there being like intellectuals who are puppets on strings or something like that. It's just a system that kind of vacuums people up and they operate in terms of their own agency, but they often exercise opportunism in order to give to the system what it wants. And so a lot of the story of the book, actually, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the PSB and CIA and the intelligence agencies. These are just the ways in which the political legal superstructure kind of intercedes in the cultural apparatus to guarantee that it functions the way that it should. But one thing that's very important is that the cultural apparatus, if it's functioning as it should within the imperial system, doesn't actually need direct intercession on the part of the political legal apparatus. There are many intellectuals who are doing precisely the type of work that is required by the Imperial Academy, and they have no direct connections, as far as we know, to the U.S. national security state. And it's even better for the U.S. national security state if that is the case, because then they don't have any of the kind of blowback or the problems that Ali was mentioning. One of the other things I just wanted to highlight really quickly is a thematic in the book is that another aspect of the inverted Marxism is so many of those who are members of the kind of radical intelligentsia, if you will, in some broad sense in the imperial core, is that they reject party politics as being corrupt and just as bad as anything else. And they generally reject state power, right? So anti-state, anti-party becomes one of the dominant mantras of the kind of radical intelligentsia. And of course, what that does is it completely disempowers organized politics from being able to use the structures that have proven themselves capable of actually waging a winning war against imperialism. So they actually have a losing strategy that they maintain as a kind of necessary touchstone. There was a question from Benjamin who asked, U.S. empire is special. It does not run colonies directly. Instead, it invests in shaping consciousness, narratives, and meaning. How can we respond to build revolutionary consciousness? It's a big question, but I do think that you touch on something important. You know, the U.S. is itself a settler colony and has directly colonized in certain cases, but a lot of its strategy has been the construction, to reference Magdoff, for instance, of an invisible empire, you know, an empire that isn't as visible as the dominant empires of the 19th century, for instance. And so part of the ideological work that's necessary is to reveal the extent to which their ideological production runs cover for their empire and to bring to the fore all of the different shrewd strategies they've used to kind of try to invisibilize their empire. I actually have an undergraduate class that I'm teaching, and I ask my students after, you know, we're 2/3 of the way into the semester and I've taught them plenty of things, if they thought of the U.S. as an empire, and not a single one did. And this is highly representative. There's a programmed, systematic ignorance regarding empire. And so part of the ideological war has to be dismantling the obfuscation that doesn't allow us to see how the empire functions. And that requires building a kind of left culture, right? This is, I think, one of Ali's points, is that we need a left intellectual culture. But to do that, we can't do it individually, right? We need to do it collectively. And we also need institutional power, right? So what Monthly Review has been doing for over 75 years, what we've been trying to do in a small way with the Critical Theory Workshop or other platforms, you need the institutional mechanisms by which you can foster collective work that is pushing in the right direction, bringing people in, building power, and also training everyone so that you're being educated by the others involved in those projects. And that has to be internationalist, right? We have to be plugged into an international network so that we're learning from, in particular, the Marxists across the global South, but just have a much broader and capacious engagement with intellectual production so that we don't suffer from the kind of institutionalized forms of social chauvinism. Anton, you asked, how does this book fit in with the fascist narrative that we have all been subjected to since at least World War II? What does it say about Gaza? Again, this is a tiny question that should only take a minute or two to respond to. I mean, it's very broad. I don't know if I'm going to be able to say much more than that. One of the through lines of the book is actually a kind of counter to the dominant ideological narrative put forth by the United States, and that is that it is an anti-fascist force in the world. There was a blip in the history of the United States when it happened to be forced, really, because it wanted to come out on the winning side of World War II, into an alliance with the Soviet Union. But it has a long and deep history that I don't have time to go into now of aiding, abetting, supporting, promoting various forces that we can have debates about exactly what the terms are that we'd want to use, but that certainly resemble fascism or, you know, fascistic forms of repression. And they, of course, since World War II, in fact, beginning during World War II, have integrated an incredible number, tens if not hundreds of thousands of direct fascists and Nazis into what can be referred to as a fascist international, but always under the cover of a kind of liberal version of democracy promotion. What do you say to people who believe that you're using the critique of the Frankfurt School to paint a broad brush against Western Marxism as a whole? I've been running into this critique a lot. The reason I focused on the Frankfurt School is because they've played such a foundational role in Western Marxism, as well as a kind of pole position within the imperial theory industry. So when you read contemporary figures like Judith Butler, Adorno is one of their major references. And you could go through, you know, many other contemporary figures, and they're drawing directly or indirectly on the Frankfurt School. I do have in the book, as well as, for instance, in the dialogue with John that he mentioned a moment ago in a recent issue of Monthly Review, broader critiques of Western Marxism. I'd also point people to the introduction that Jennifer and I co-authored to Lasordo's Western Marxism that was published by Monthly Review Press. And in those writings and some others, as well as, you know, John's writings on this, Ali's writings on this, there is a kind of broader engagement with the more general corpus of Western Marxism. And I think that if you take my critiques of the Frankfurt School and look at the essence of those critiques, that what we have is a kind of Marxism in theory, that's ultimately an inverted Marxism, and an anti-communist, capitalist, and imperialist accommodationist in practice. And actually, many of them also allied directly with fascists in the post-war era, as I just briefly mentioned. That's the kind of core position. And that you will find, unfortunately, in many other Western Marxists. Now, what I offered methodologically is what I refer to as a constellational approach. I could not have gone into as much detail about every single figure in the Frankfurt School or every figure in the Western Marxist tradition and written a book that, you know, kept under 500 pages. But what I did is I chose particular nodal points that I thought were important: Adorno, Horkheimer, and Marcuse, because they're the leading figures and because of what they reveal. Now, anyone else could do the same thing by taking someone like Perry Anderson or other major figures, Kevin Anderson, you know, in this, and then flesh out in greater detail how they're situated. I would be absolutely shocked, and please reach out to me and let me know, if somehow miraculously they were breaking with the dominant ideology that has tended to pervade Western Marxism. There will be some idiosyncratic differences, and I point some of those out, like Marcuse was a bit open to Cuba because he thought of it as kind of anti-Soviet, at least in the early years. He was interested in China as potentially being anti-Soviet, but he still remained an anti-communist. So we have to kind of flesh out all of those relations. Callum Roche asked, can you say something about how your book's thesis connects to Mark Fisher's Vampire Castle? I don't know Vampire Castle, but I know Mark Fisher's work, which I think is really, I mean, it would be another version of Western Marxism. It was very widely promoted. And like some of the other work, it's a kind of witty intervention and did some interesting things, but the horizons remain very much limited insofar as it's not a version of Marxism that focuses on the trials and tribulations and the difficulty of building socialism in the real world. Instead, it tends to think that, well, it's more difficult to imagine the end of capitalism than the end of the world. Well, it's not a question of imagining the end of capitalism. It's a matter actually of studying the material history of the peoples of this world who have been struggling in the most difficult conditions imaginable to develop that alternative world in the real world of the here and now. And that's why we need a reorientation away from the imaginary left, the utopian left, the kind of post-socialist utopian socialism that is so widespread. And instead, we need to examine and analyze the complexities of the dialectics of socialism, which doesn't mean that anyone who waves the red flag is celebrated as the greatest revolutionary of all time, but that we actually engage in serious materialist analyses of these projects. And we point out very important things like when there are advances and major wins. I mentioned the fact that the Soviet Union defeated the Nazi war machine. You know, primarily, there were other factors involved, but without the Soviet Union, you would not have had the global defeat of Nazism and of fascism. You could also point to the fact that there was an enormous study done in the 1980s that I point to in the book by Waitzkin and Sarasoto that demonstrated, based on World Bank data, that socialist countries have overwhelmingly outperformed capitalist countries concerning the physical quality of life index, which is life expectancy, infant mortality, and literacy rates, right? So there is a large body of data that has demonstrated the superiority of actually existing socialism over actually existing capitalism. Maybe the last thing I'd say in this regard is that when you analyze socialism from a non-utopian perspective, so scientifically, it's not a matter of socialism measuring up to some image you would have in your mind. Everything is relational if you approach the world dialectically. We live in a capitalist world of unbridled social murder and ecocide and the possibility of a nuclear apocalypse and the end of life as we know it. That should be our point of comparison for actually existing socialism. What actually existing socialism has done is lifted literally millions of people out of the most abject conditions of poverty, immiseration, social murder, and so forth. We need to stop just ignoring actually existing socialism and instead scientifically engage in it in the most rigorous manner possible so that we can give ourselves the tools necessary, theoretically and practically, to move the world in the right direction.